From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. There has been tremendous concern around the pollution of our oceans, our soil and food systems, and even our bodies from plastic waste. Now, a new study has examined a little discussed impact, how plastic waste exacerbates climate change. The Center for International Environmental Law produced the study called Plastic and Climate, the Hidden Costs of a Plastic Planet, and found, among other things, that, quote, the production and incineration of plastic will produce more than 850 million metric tons of greenhouse gases. That's equivalent to the emissions from 189 500 megawatt coal power plants. The report calls for an end to the production and use of single-use disposable plastic and the curtailing of new oil, gas, and petrochemical infrastructure. We turn to Carol Muffett, President and CEO of the Center for International Environmental Law. Welcome, Carol.
It's nice to be here.
So let's first talk about why this report examined this link. We, as I said, you know, there have been lots of studies on plastic pollution, how it's, you know, entering our food systems. It's even found in human bodies. It, of course, deeply impacts marine life. But is the climate impact of plastic an overlooked impact?
That is exactly right. And we set out to understand the scale of that impact. I think it's important to recognize that plastics are pervasive in our economy, they're pervasive in our lives, and they're pervasive in our environment. And as you said, there's been a growing awareness over the last many years that the impacts of plastics, particularly on ocean ecosystems, are completely unsustainable and in many cases catastrophic. There's also been a much slower but equally significant rising awareness that plastics are affecting human health at every stage of the plastics life cycle. So what CL set out to do, and we set out to do it with a number of partners, each of whom were experts in a specific aspect of that life cycle, was to understand what are the total climate impacts of our continued production and use and disposal of plastics and its release into the environment. And I'll say that what we found was really staggering. The scale of the impacts really surprised us. And it's important to recognize that plastics are simply fossil fuels in another form. 99% of what goes into plastics are oil, gas, and to a lesser extent, coal feedstocks. And as a result of this, you know, the processes that produce plastics begin at wellheads and at frack pads across the United States and around the world. And so the first thing that we did was look at, well, what are the proportions of those emissions from fracking, from oil development that can be attributed to plastics, and what's the scale of those emissions? The Frack Tracker Alliance led that piece of the work. And an important part of what they found was that in addition to the significant impacts of fracking and the for plastics and the significant greenhouse gas releases from that fracking and those operations, much of the climate impact of those operations is nearly impossible to quantify. It ranges from the climate impacts of the trucks that move fracking water and fracking sand and fracking waste, down the pipelines to the leakage of methanes from pipelines and compressor stations, many of which aren't even accurately counted in official government estimates.
So essentially, your report is examining every aspect of the life cycle of plastic, from the very, you know, extraction of the ingredients that are used to make the plastic all the way to its disposal, every part of the life cycle of a piece of plastic?
Exactly. And it doesn't end with the disposal of the plastics. I think a really fundamental finding of our report is that even after the usable life of a piece of plastic ends, its emissions don't. Those emissions go on sometimes in perpetuity. So after the plastics, you know, after the plastics leave the pipelines and the refineries, then they move into processing plants where they are responsible for massive greenhouse gas emissions. Turning feedstocks into plastic resins is extremely greenhouse gas intensive, both because of the energy it requires and because the chemical processes themselves are extremely high emitting. Even once those resins are made, however, the emissions from plastics and from the plastics life cycle continue. We see those emissions happen particularly at the end of the plastics life, when plastics are either buried in landfills, which is relatively low emitting, or recycled, which can save emissions because you're not producing new plastics from virgin material, or increasingly and very troublingly, when plastics are incinerated. And the Global Alliance for Incinerator Alternatives, or GAIA, led this part of the research, and they actually commissioned a new economic life cycle analysis of how plastics are handled at the end of their lives and what emissions emerge from that. And I think this was one of the really surprising parts of our study, was the evidence that the rising reliance on plastic incineration in the name of waste to energy, which is pushed as a climate solution, can in fact actually dramatically increase the emissions from the plastics life cycle.
So who is incinerating plastic as a source of energy? Where is it happening, and why is it happening?
It is in fact happening increasingly worldwide. And the reasons for this are multifold. The first reason is that as if you look in the United States and you look in Europe, as China and other countries who have been absorbing plastic waste from the United States and Europe say no to new plastic waste and stop it at their borders, that is creating a crisis in the U.S. and elsewhere, because we are now forced to deal with plastic waste at a scale that we don't have the infrastructure to do.
So essentially, those of us, and I really like what you were saying earlier, that we need to be treating every piece of plastic as a piece of a petrochemical product. And so what you're saying is, you know, those of us, and we all of us are guilty of this, when we purchase things that have disposable plastic, you know, packaging or any other things, and we toss those, we feel that by tossing them into the recycling bin, we are being responsible. But because of the recent change in China's refusal to recycle plastics, now increasingly we have a glut of disposable plastic that, because it's not being recycled, is being burned and is creating even more greenhouse gas emissions.
China's refusal to accept our waste plastic exposed this problem. It didn't create
right.
it. And I think that's a really important thing to recognize. By it's for many, many years, only a tiny fraction of plastics are actually recycled. And for many years, the way that we define something as recycled in the U.S. was the moment that a bale of plastic waste got on a barge or got on a freighter and was headed out of port to China, it was treated as recycled. But in fact, once that plastic waste got to China, what the Chinese companies and workers found in that waste was that only a small fraction of it was actually economically usable in any way. And the rest was what it had always been, trash. And so when China basically said, we're not taking your trash anymore, that's forced the US and Europe to really deal with this waste in completely new ways. And one consequence of this is, in the absence of better ways to recycle this massive flood of material, municipalities in the US and particularly in Europe are relying increasingly on incineration. And the irony is, this is often done in the guise of waste to energy and treated as a climate solution. One of the reasons that we wanted to focus a particular analysis on this report is that it is now clear that this incineration that's being done in the name of addressing climate change is actually contributing to it in really fundamental ways. Mm. But that incineration is only a small part of the growth that we're seeing in emissions from plastics. And that brings me back to the big overall story. And that is, when we looked at the life cycle emissions of plastics from the wellhead to the point where they became resins. And then we combined the emissions that come from rising reliance on incineration in plastic waste management. The scale of emissions becomes truly staggering. To give you one example, in 2019 alone, we estimate that emissions from plastic production and incineration will equal 850 million metric tons of CO2. That's equivalent to 129 coal-fired power plants operating around the clock all year long. But the plastic infrastructure, the infrastructure for making new plastics, is growing incredibly rapidly. The American Chemistry Council estimates that the industry will invest $200 billion in more than 330 new or expanded projects to produce plastics and petrochemicals Wow. just in the next few years.
So we aren't we're at the stage where instead of actually tackling the problem, unfortunately, we are projected to produce more and more and more plastic.
That's exactly right. And it's really, the figures are really dramatic. By 2030, this industry could be producing 1.34 gigatons of new plastics. To put that figure in perspective, this is a massive increase in emissions from plastics at precisely the same time that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change tells us that we need to be cutting global emissions from greenhouse gases by 45%. And so plastics production and plastics incineration are moving in exactly the opposite direction. By 2050, the figures become even more stark. By 2050, we're looking at 2.8 gigatons of emissions from plastics every year, which is equivalent to 615 new coal-fired power plants.
Wow.
And if you look at the aggregate impact of those emissions, between now and 2050, the production and the incineration of plastics could release 56 gigatons of CO2 equivalent into the atmosphere. That's equivalent to 10 to up to 13% of the Earth's entire remaining carbon budget for staying below 1.5 degrees. And that's the target that the IPCC has recently urgently warned the world we cannot go beyond if the world is to have any hope of recovering from climate change.
So just ahead of your report, we heard the terrifying news that the observatory on Mauna Loa in Hawaii had recorded 415 parts per million of carbon dioxide levels in our atmosphere, a level not seen for 3 million years. It was last 3 million years ago that our Earth had such levels of carbon dioxide. Also recently released was a study in early May by the International Monetary Fund, and I don't know if you saw this, but it's relevant to this conversation we're having, that found that the subsidies received by the fossil fuel industry from the U.S. government, and so we're just talking about the U.S. alone, exceed that of our already far too high Pentagon budget. So we're subsidizing this deadly and destructive industry to such a huge extent that even our military, you know, gets less funding than the fossil fuel industry if you measure it through subsidies.
That's exactly right. And I think in really fundamental ways, we as a society are being forced to subsidize our own destruction. Mm. A new study came out from the International Energy Agency, which also identified the petrochemical and plastics industry as a climate problem hiding in plain sight, as a blind spot in our response to climate change because of the massive growth in this industry and its tremendous capacity for emissions. One of the things that the International Energy Agency highlighted was that between now and 2050, the plastics and petrochemical industry will account for 50% of all of the demand growth for oil worldwide. In other words, 50% of the extra oil that we use between now and 2050 is going to go into petrochemicals. This isn't surprising because one of the things our research shows is that as global recognition of the need to transition away from fossil fuels for energy and transportation increases, the oil companies and gas companies, who are also not coincidentally the same companies who make plastics, Exxon, Chevron, Shell, Total, those companies are increasingly relying on petrochemicals and plastics to make their long-term business models add up.
So essentially, and because they know that fossil fuels are being phased out and that people are coming to the realization, they're trying to sell the same destructive product to people in another way. In a way, they're relying on our ignorance of the plastic products in our day-to-day lives being linked to the same industry and having the same impact on our climate.
I think that's exactly right. And I think one of the things that we're seeing is that as people begin to recognize that these problems are deeply linked, that the problem that the climate crisis and the plastics crisis, and indeed the toxic impacts that come from all of the additives that pervade a plastic economy, as people realize that these problems are all fundamentally linked at their source, it becomes clear that we can't respond to these problems in isolation. We have to deal with them together. And so, you know, that brings us to some of the fundamental findings and recommendations from
our
report.
Yes, what do you recommend?
What we recommend is that this is not a place where half solutions make sense. The most urgent need, that the world has already determined that we can't afford to use plastics at nearly the scale that we're using them. Their impacts are too dramatic, both on human health, on ecosystems, and now clearly on the climate. And yet industry is moving ahead full speed in this massive new build out of plastics infrastructure. So the first challenge for us, and the first and most urgent need, is to stop that expansion of the infrastructure to make ever greater quantities of plastics. At the same time as we stop that build out of new petrochemical infrastructure, we need to look at the root drivers of that build out, and that is the massive supplies of oil and gas in our economy, and the fact that companies are looking for what to do with that oil and gas. The IPCC has made clear that if we're going to address the climate crisis, the world needs to transition urgently and completely away from fossil fuels. And that means that the next and very fundamental step in addressing the plastic crisis is also the first step in addressing the climate crisis, and that is to keep fossil fuels in the ground in the first place. It's important to recognize that because plastics are essentially a byproduct of the production and refining of fossil fuels for transportation and energy, they are effectively subsidized by our reliance on fossil fuels for energy and transportation. And so if we start learning to keep fossil fuels in the ground, the economics of plastics production will itself fundamentally change. And when those economics change, we'll start to focus much more clearly on the plastics that the world absolutely has to have, and the much larger volume of plastics, the massive quantity of plastics that the world can't afford and doesn't need.
Right. So essentially, rather than saying no new fossil fuel, or let's transition away from fossil fuel energy to more sustainable energy, maybe the message needs to be no new oil and gas production, period. No extraction. Leave it in the ground, as a lot of activists have said. And then to your point around the issue of plastic waste and what is absolutely needed. We of course know that, for example, the medical industry uses plastic, and it can be a life-saving resource, if you will. There are, you know, people who rely on plastics for some very necessary things. So if we can change the way we treat plastic ourselves, from something to just buy and throw away, to something that is a very precious resource to be used minimally, we can transition our mindset, right?
I think that's right. And I think it's really important to recognize that, you know, more than 40% of the plastics that move through the economy and move through our lives come in the form of single-use disposable plastics, primarily plastic packaging.
And water bottles and all those unnecessary things that we just don't really need in our lives.
Exactly. And so there is a huge room for eliminating these plastics from our economy, from our lives, and from our ecosystems. And at the same time, it's important to recognize that those single-use disposable plastics and that plastic packaging are actually the major driver for the build-out of new plastic infrastructure. And so they're saying
consumer demand is what's driving this.
Well, the industry likes to say that it is responding to consumer demand. What our research suggests is that plastics, to a far greater extent than virtually any other product or any other commodity, is actually a matter of supply driving demand rather than the opposite. You know, we are seeing this build out in new plastics infrastructure not because of a rising demand for plastics, but in fact because there's a massive glut of very cheap natural gas and natural gas feedstocks on the U.S. market that's been driven by the fracking boom. And the industry has been seizing on that glut of cheap feedstocks to build new infrastructure, not to serve U.S. markets, not to meet demand in the U.S., because there's actually a surplus of plastics in the U.S., but rather to increase its exports to plastics globally, with the particular goal of increasing consumption and increasing demand in the global South. Unfortunately for the industry, what they're likely to find is that in communities across the global South and increasingly among governments in the global South, they are starting to recognize the impacts of plastics and starting to recognize that they, as governments and as communities, can no longer afford those impacts. And so the growth that the industry has been anticipating or hoping to create in plastics consumption in the global South, I think if you look at what's happening globally with the new recently adopted amendments to the Basel Convention just last week, and the progress that's been made towards a potential negotiation of a global agreement on plastics in Nairobi earlier this year, the leaders in those negotiations have been coming from the global South, and they've been demanding solutions to this plastics crisis.
Right, because they see a lot of pollution of their lands and water as well. There have been many cities in the global South that have banned plastic bags and other disposable, single-use disposable plastic items as well. So I'm wondering finally, Carol, whether you think that reports like this will add to the growing concern among populations else, you know, everywhere here in the U.S. and outside, that we just have to end this reliance on plastic. I know there's pressure, you know, by consumers for grocery stores to phase out single-use plastic packaging. And certainly we've already seen plastic bag bans around the country. There have been plastic straw bans as well, although I know there's some concern among people from the disability rights community about the importance of and need for straws at restaurants. But it seems as though there is a growing concern from the public and awareness from the public.
I think there is growing concern, and I think there is growing recognition of the array of impacts, the array of prices we pay for the plastics that move through our lives, often unsolicited. And I think there's a growing recognition within the public that these crises, the climate crisis, the plastic crisis, the toxic economy that we face, that they are all deeply linked. And that brings me to, you know, one of the other goals that we had with this report was simply to better understand the scale of the impacts of plastics on the climate, because it's been a blind spot in our response to the plastics problem. And this brings me to one of the most troubling things to emerge from our report. And I'll have to say one of the most frightening things that I have seen in many years working on climate issues. We identified five gyres led the section of the report that looks at what happens to plastics once they're released out into the environment, in the oceans and in the landscape and beyond. And they found three fundamentally related things. First, microplastics, as they break down in the oceans, and there are 57 trillion particles of microplastics in at the ocean surface. Those microplastics, as they break down in the oceans, they continue to release methane and other greenhouse gases more or less continuously. Even more importantly, not only are microplastics releasing greenhouse gases in the oceans, but the microplastics that occur on beaches and on shorelines and on agricultural lands and landscapes around the world are also off-gassing methane and other greenhouse gases at even faster rates. We don't yet understand the full scale of this problem because it is very difficult to quantify the emissions that are happening because we can only see a tiny, tiny fraction of a percent of the plastics that are at the surface and in the oceans. But the other truly frightening thing that came from our research was the small but growing body of evidence that plastics may actually be interfering in fundamental ways with the organisms that not only sit at the base of ocean food chains, but also play a vital role in the ocean's function as the largest natural carbon sink on the planet. It's important to recognize that since the industrial era began, the oceans have absorbed between 20 and 40% of all of the anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions that people have produced. That's 20 to 40% of those emissions that otherwise would have gone into the atmosphere and accelerated warming still further. That oceanic carbon sink functions in large part because of a biological carbon pump. And that carbon pump has two components to it. On the one hand, it has phytoplankton and carbon-fixing bacteria that are responsible for photosynthesizing, for fixing carbon at the ocean surface through photosynthesis. And those bacteria and the phytoplankton, in turn, are then eaten by zooplankton, which take that carbon that's been fixed by the phytoplankton and they pump it down to the deep ocean where it can't interact with the atmosphere and it can't contribute to warming. And so that biological carbon pump is a big part of what makes the oceanic carbon sink work. And unfortunately, there's a growing body of evidence that in ocean basins around the world, whether it's in the North Pacific or the North Atlantic or the Indian Ocean off of Kenya or the South China Sea off of China, those plankton are being contaminated by or they are ingesting microplastics in huge quantities. And the research is very early, but research has demonstrated that for some of these species, particularly really important and abundant ones, this plastic contamination can, for the phytoplankton, reduce their ability to photosynthesize the carbon in the first place. And for the zooplankton, it can reduce their metabolic rates by up to 40%. It can reduce their survival rates, and it can reduce the health and the survival rates of their offspring. So what are the impacts of this? We simply don't know yet. But when you consider that there are 57 trillion particles of microplastics in the ocean, and that is at the ocean surface, and that is in all likelihood a minimum estimate, and that those figures are growing every year, year in and year out, and that the smaller those particles get, the more readily ingested they are by these ocean organisms at the base of global food chains and at the base of the biological carbon pump, the implications are profound. So I think one of the key messages from our research is the urgent need for more research and the need for the recognition that at some point the precautionary principle needs to come into play. And we need to recognize that even while we wait for new and better information to come out, we need to start taking action now to address the severity of this crisis.
Right, as we've heard some progressive politicians call out other politicians, this is not the time for half measures or middle of the road gestures on the issue of our climate. The time for urgency is absolutely now. Give out a website, Carol, where people can find information and read the report we've been discussing.
Yes, absolutely. People can find the report at our website. It's www.ciel.org, and people can stay abreast of the plastics news and all of the work that's going on to address the plastic crisis by following the hashtag #BreakFreeFromPlastics on Twitter and Facebook.
We'll link to those from our website. Thanks so much, Carol.
It was lovely talking with you.
My guest has been Carol Muffett, President and CEO of the Center for International Environmental Law. We've been discussing a new report about the climate impacts of plastics. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.